I think when I was 18, particularly, like, I had just had an idea of, like, this is what it's going to be to go out there, and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, and I'll see this, and it will all be, like, this amazing experience. And then I got typhoid.
Oh.
And we were living in quite a basic house at the time, and we didn't have water a lot of the time, and the electricity went. And we got so many monkeys that would come on the roof of the house. And I just remember this day, I was so ill, and I wanted to go to the bathroom in the night, and then it was 45 degrees, no fan, no light, and I'm ill. And I don't have my parents. And it's like, you know, I'm trying to prove to everyone, like, I can do this. And I remember that being a very hard moment. I remember phoning home. And as I said, my dad's very pastoral. He does member care. And he's like, I'll come on a plane and get you. And then my mum came on the phone. No, he won't. You chose to do this. You are staying there.
Hi, guys. Welcome back to Raw Mission, the podcast where we bring you challenging and inspiring stories of ordinary folks sharing the good news of our extraordinary God in some of the toughest parts of the world. Now, I want to introduce today's episode with a few statistics. India, with 1.4 billion people, is soon to become the most populous nation on Earth, overtaking China. It's also the country with the most unreached people groups. There are over 1.3 billion classified as unreached, and over a billion that the Joshua Project calls unengaged, meaning there's a huge need for more gospel workers, both to cross state boundaries inside India and to come and live there from around the world.
It's also the world's third most populous Muslim nation.
With around 200 million Muslims, that's about the same number as all Arabic-speaking Muslims worldwide. And it's India where today's guest spent many years. It's a shorter episode because we recorded it a few weeks ago at a church leaders' conference here in the UK. But you'll hear about how Becky's love for Jesus has driven her to travel around the world to care for marginalized women, to work with refugees and asylum seekers, and to speak of God's kingdom wherever she goes.
Well, good afternoon, Becky. It's great to have you here. We are live today at a conference in the Midlands in England, and we're going to hear some of your stories. So tell us a little bit about, just very quickly, where are you from, Becky? And where did you end up serving overseas?
So I'm from Liverpool originally, and I am currently working with refugees in Liverpool. But I spent a number of years out in India and have been back in the UK for the last 10 years, visiting various teams and people in other parts of the world.
Great. And how did you end up going from Liverpool to North India?
It's a very long story, which I can cut short, but when I was in my later teens, I was probably a little bit frustrated in church, a bit bored, and was just so passionate about how I saw Jesus live. And I wanted to see how that could be lived out in community. And that led me into friendships and relationships with people that were doing that overseas. My family were involved, and I was taken by my dad on a trip to Jordan when I was 14. And I was told to look after the kids while he was doing member care visits and checking on people that were living out there. And I got the privilege to go to some Palestinian refugee camps. And it was heartbreaking in many ways at 14 to see such a different way of life and an experience, especially for women. And I think from that point, I just saw a different way to live out Christian community, to live out faith in a way that could be transformational that maybe I hadn't experienced before. And I think that was the first taste of something that then led me on my own journey and my own questions. And that led me out to India when I was 18.
Wow. There are quite a few different motivations, I think, in all of us when we get into cross-cultural work. For me, definitely, travel was a part of it, seeing people around the world, different cultures, realizing the opportunities we've had in this country to hear about Jesus and those around the world who don't get those same opportunities. Mm-hmm. And then others are really driven by compassion and wanting to care for the poor and seeing desperate poverty.
Yeah.
Where did you sort of fall amongst all those different motivations that we have for serving Jesus overseas?
I think it's always been a mix. I think I love travel. I love experiencing new things and seeing God's diversity in his creation and that within cultures as well. So there was always that element that I loved. But then alongside that is the reality that so many people live in such awful conditions around the world, and particularly women. God had put on my heart. So in India, one of my focuses was to work alongside women that were marginalized. So that could be divorcees, widowed women. They wouldn't be given opportunities for employment. Often they're cut off from their families, so they would be financially in very difficult situations. So I think it was a real mix of my own gender, my own love of travel and seeing the world, but also wanted to make a difference within that. I was passionate about actually how can we meet the needs of that community and the challenge within that. So we set up a business that would provide employability for those ladies. And our focus was often to offer employment to women that just wouldn't find it elsewhere.
That's really special. Yeah, catching something of God's heart throughout scriptures, you know, we see so much of his concern for justice, don't we? And then we also see, you know, this is also the God who wants relationship with us. So it's always a twin motivation, isn't it, really? God's heart for the lost and his heart for the poor, the brokenhearted, and those suffering injustice. We'll come on to more of that, definitely, as we go through your story. Okay, 18 years old, you're in India. Presumably, you didn't move out there long-term at 18.
No, I was there for 6 months, and I was with a group of Brazilians, actually. It was an amazing project that had come out of Brazil, where they sent 100 Brazilians on a common purse out to different parts of the world, and I had the privilege to go and live with a group of them that were sent out to India. So that was my first contact with Brazilians. Watching them interact in a different culture as well. So I was not only a British person going out to India, but it was a very cross-cultural team. And that was just an amazing experience, those 6 months, deeply challenging. And then I just knew that I wanted to go back at the end of that experience. So
you already at that point felt, this is it for me, India. You fell in love with India, because some people struggle with India.
Yeah.
I mean, I was 18 actually when I first went to India, and I spent 4 or 5 months out there. And it's wild, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a crazy place and so different, so diverse. It's a continent, not just a country, really. So what were your first experiences? I mean, paint a picture for our audience here and the listeners out there of what is India like when you first arrive, especially as a young single girl?
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot for all of your senses in one go. So as an extrovert, the fact that there's people everywhere all the time, it's like, you know, dream come true and people to talk to all the time. So I loved the fact that there is people everywhere and it's people focused. And in our culture, time is really important, whereas there, like, people are important and the food and being around the table. And I learned just so much about just how to live in community around a table in India rather than at home. But yeah, the smells, the noises, the colors, everything is very bright. And if you don't mind the heat, then I think that you can get on really well in India. And good food,
amazing food.
So always well fed, always something new to try. As you said, it's like it's a continent within itself. So every town you go to, different types of foods, different clothes, new things to learn, new things to get wrong, and everyone laugh at you. If you can laugh at yourself, you're all right. So yeah, good fun if you can embrace the mad moments of cows in the street and lots of traffic. So
noise, pollution.
And
it is a country of extremes, isn't it? I agree with you. The thing about the senses, I used to call it an assault on the senses. Every religion, you know, you're the Buddhists and the Hindus and the Muslims and the Christians, everything and everywhere, and the animals and the rickshaws. It really is. It's fascinating. It's interesting you say as an extrovert you loved it, because I'm jumping fast forwarding now, but back in my days in North Pakistan, we found that the introverts, especially the ladies, did very well in North Pakistan because it was the mountains. It was quieter. Everything shut down when the electricity sort of was finished at nighttime. And it was really hard for the extroverts up there. But some parts of South Asia, the big cities, brilliant if you're an extrovert. You don't mind people all over you just with such friendliness. Then that's great. Yeah, gosh, we could talk about India a lot. But okay, so you've done a few months out there. You've fallen in love, in a sense, with God's heart for the nations and caring for widows and so on. And also you've experienced intercultural team life with all these Brazilians. So what happened next in your story?
So I think one thing that was always really important to me, perhaps it was my dad's guidance as well, as someone that has visited so many teams. He was just like, what are you going to actually do? Like, what are you going to tell people? What are you going to offer? what's going to be your identity in the community that you live. And it was wise words, not ones I wanted to hear when I was 18, but I came back and I decided to study, and I studied English. And then I went on, when we went back to India, I started a language school. So that idea of like, who are you going to be in that place was always a big question. So that, I suppose that drove me to think, okay, what am I going to do to prepare myself to go longer term and to have a sustainable lifestyle there within the context of a community? What am I offering? What needs am I helping to meet? So I took those 3 years, studied my degree, and then within that time, met my husband, we got married, and we went together.
And he happens to be Brazilian
To be Brazilian.
No connection to that early team?
Yeah, he was on that early team, although I didn't meet him at that time. He wasn't there. He's a linguist, so that sort of went really well, you know. And he'd already spent time out in India, learnt the language and things like that, so...
Which language was that that you were learning then? Was it Urdu or something else?
Yeah, so Urdu, but Hindi, really. They're very similar spoken languages with a different script.
Yeah. So we've got a lot in common with my English teaching in North Pakistan. And of course, I've been not just when I was 18 around India, but actually I think I know the town where you ended up serving. How many years were you out there in North India?
So I was there for 8 years.
It's a very long time. And we've got some mutual friends out there, don't we?
Yes, yes.
Which is great. In fact, a few years ago, I did a visit to that town. What I remember about your town is I went one evening to this, it was like a mosque, I suppose we would call it, Shia version of a mosque, I suppose, the Imam Barga. And it was a sort of festival night. And they had one of these occasions where they had hot burning coals laid out in a trench that they had dug. And all the men were there and they were chanting and getting themselves really whipped up and excited, and they were all going to just plow through, walking through these hot burning coals. I'd seen it once before, years previously in India, in a Hindu context, I think.
Okay.
But this was fascinating, seeing these guys just walking right through these burning hot coals and out onto the cool grass on the other side. But very interesting, and just getting into conversations with some of the Muslims there. Mm-hmm. Were you spending a lot of time specifically with Muslims, or just anyone, Muslims and Hindus?
So initially, we spent time just getting to know whoever was brought into our path. And then as we engaged a little bit more and understood the city more, we came to realize that a lot of maybe the historical missionary efforts or efforts to share about Jesus had been within particular communities. We then started to pray and research, found out that there were particular groups of Muslim people that had no known believers amongst them. And we didn't know of anyone particularly within that community that had made friends, or there was no signs of any work, I suppose, going on amongst those communities. So my husband and I started to pray, because it's not easy, especially trying to find where those groups are, how to identify them. Because India's population is huge. And we did live in the state where there is a large number of those groups of people. So in Uttar Pradesh.
40 million people, or is it 40 million Muslims, perhaps? It's a huge, huge number, isn't it? Even in state in India.
It's a huge number. Like, I think it's more now. I think it's around 190 million people in the state.
In the state, of which probably 50, 60 million then are Muslim.
Yeah, that's probably the statistics. Wow. So... We started to pray particularly, and it wasn't easy, but we started to employ some people. And then it's not the first thing that you ask people, like, and what people group are you from, or what group are you? But actually, as time went by, we found out that about four or five of the girls that we were working with were all from that group that we'd been praying for.
That's cool.
And that was really special for us. And we learned a lot through that. Because sometimes we can get so focused on some sort of target, and we lose the fact that these are people with a story, and rather than thinking about data and trying to tick people off lists, it was like, actually, who are the people God's bringing to us? And I suppose we learned a good lesson through that actually there was a need within this community, and we just asked God to help us to serve that community. And he brought those people to us with really little effort from our part.
Sharing this podcast is a really good way to encourage more people to get involved with God's great mission, whether locally or globally. So please do help us get the word out there. If you use an iPhone, it's pretty easy to write us a review. and that has a big impact on how many people can find us. Alternatively, you could share one of your favourite episodes with a few of your friends. Thanks, guys, and now let's get back to the podcast. One of the challenges we found in South Asia, where often, especially if you're working in poor communities, is they look at us and the dream of a ticket to the West or the visa.
Yeah.
Or these guys, maybe just employment.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find, you know, building relationships when there's that imbalance of wealth, perhaps, and you're thinking, well, I want to bring these guys to Jesus, not just to Western values or money or a visa out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you find people were wanting to get involved in spiritual conversations with you?
Yeah, well, one of the benefits is that my husband looks very Indian.
Yeah.
And spoke the language like a local. So that definitely was something that was helpful. But yeah, I think that there is always that reality, you know, with my face walking down the street, people make a lot of assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
However, we found that, you know, those barriers were overcome quite quickly and we had sincere relationships. And because of the number of religions that are practiced in India, people are very awake to spiritual conversations, very open to that.
Mm.
So as long as you were ready to listen to other people's stories and other people's practices, then there was an open space for you to also share your own.
Mm.
So I used to love going to Eid and being able to celebrate with them and share in their festivals. And then equally, they would be very welcome in our home to do the same.
Mm.
And so you start to build that very authentic, genuine relationship. And I think people can feel.
That's good. And English teaching is quite a good vehicle for that, isn't
it?
Because
yeah.
You're in these classes, you're discussing, you're trying to use different vocabulary and language. And
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I found in Pakistan at the university where I taught and in the other English classes, often the students just say, sir, you know, what's Christmas, sir? You know, tell us about that. Even if it's a cultural question, there's mm-hmm. a very easy answer that leads to a spiritual story there.
Yeah.
Or a personal testimony.
Yeah.
I'm sure you found the same things.
Definitely. And I think that the idea of the existence of God and even the concept that there is a spiritual element to life is very real, even though it's expressed very differently. So in many ways, I found those conversations much easier than maybe I do in some contexts here in the
definitely.
UK.
Give us some of your toughest moments of living in North India when you just were so angry or just ready to throw in the towel. Maybe not everyone has those, but sometimes, or just such frustrations with the bugs and the insects or the heat, whatever it was. What were some of the hardest things up there for you?
I think one of the hardest things was, I think when I was 18, particularly, like I had just had an idea of like, this is what it's going to be to go out there and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And I'll see this and it will all be like this amazing experience. And then I got typhoid. And we were living in quite a basic house at the time and we didn't have water a lot of the time and the electricity went. And we got so many monkeys that would come on the roof of the house. And I just remember this day, I was so ill and I wanted to go to the bathroom in the night. And then it was 45 degrees, no fan, no light. And I'm ill. And I don't have my parents. And it's like, you know, I'm trying to prove to everyone, like, I can do this. And I remember that being a very hard moment. I remember phoning home. And as I said, my dad's very pastoral. He does member care. And he's like, I'll come on a plane and get you. And then my mum came on the phone. No, he won't. You chose to do this. You are staying there.
When you're feeling sick and you've got the stomach troubles or typhoid, I can't imagine how bad that is. But my wife, when she was in Indonesia, had dengue fever.
Oh yeah,
that's when everything suddenly just feels different. Why am I doing this, God? What is the point? Where's the fruit? Years and years of learning language, and is it worth it? And so much we have to see with the eyes of faith, don't we? Because day to day, it can be boring or frustrating. Or what about when you lived there long term? Then later on, what were some of the harder things then?
I think some of the harder things was the distance from family. The culture becomes very different as a married person and also then a married person with children. Just the experience of having children in the hospital there. And then it's not just my own life, you know, like my own choices impacting me. It's I've got two kids. And my kids till today, like they say that they're Indian. I mean, they have no Indian paperwork. But yeah, they have a real strong sentiment to their time in India. They love it. But as a parent at that time, it was very stressful to make those decisions. Mm. Electricity would go and you'd have a kid screaming in 45 degrees with no aircon.
Yes.
And sometimes it would go for days. One time, actually, I remember I was pregnant with my second child and my husband was in Afghanistan. And something had happened and there'd been like something, I don't know if some attack had happened in like Kabul. And my husband was there. Mm. I couldn't get hold of him. And I was going mental. I was so angry with him. And then I thought, oh, wait, what if something had happened to him? And I'm fuming. And so, yeah, there was those moments where it was like, why is he in Afghanistan? And I'm about to deliver a baby in 2 weeks. Why have we made these very good life choices? Yeah. But he came back and it was a great experience. So, yeah. And baby was born all okay. So. Yes.
Hindsight is a beautiful thing, isn't yes. it? In the moment, doesn't feel good. Yeah. Interesting. And now you've also been over to my side of the border into North Pakistan, yes. haven't you? Tell us about that trip.
That was an amazing trip. That was a long time ago now. It's in 2007, but it was part of a prayer trip to go and pray in those nations. And we were part of a big group and we broke into smaller groups and our group went to Pakistan and what came out of Kazakhstan through China and into northern Pakistan. It was really interesting because obviously the history between India and Pakistan, there's so many things in the culture and because where we were living in India is a Muslim city, mm-hmm. then you could see just how similar the culture is. It was a great experience. It was a tense time in Pakistan. Some people love that, you know, to be able to tell the tales. It wasn't the easiest of times.
Yeah. You had an incident, didn't you, in the Northeast?
Yeah, we had an incident where, you know, this is the reality of like when people think about when you're going to places to share Jesus. There are ways in which we have to do that in sensitive ways. And yes. So we were on a wider team and someone on the team had got in conversation and the local police had found out that there was a group of Christians in this hotel and the only person's passport that they wanted to see was mine. I was like, oh, great. I followed all the rules. We had to very quickly get in the van and get away with. So that was quite tense experience. And as I said, some people thought that was, you know, the most fabulous experience to come and tell the tale. I was quite glad to drive off.
Definitely. There's a lot of unknowns and I think powerlessness, isn't it? When you step into a culture, you become powerless. You don't understand what's going on, often linguistically or culturally.
Yeah.
And it can be frightening, very frightening sometimes. I mean, I never prayed as much as when I just got into the car and drove in North Pakistan because the roads are crazy and the landslides and the dangers. In some ways, it stretches your faith and it's a good thing because you lean on God and you cry out to him and you see him at work in so many ways and you've got that sense of team and purpose. So there's some great things, but there are some times where, no, this is scary. Yeah. This is not fun. Especially, did you find that when you got married, your anxiety levels changed a bit? Or as a mother, it changed a bit from when you were just single and it's just me to worry about?
Yeah, I think, especially when I had the kids, I think that it does change something. Obviously, the sense of responsibility. It's just a natural thing wherever you live anyway.
Yeah.
I think that making decisions was a little bit different, which was one of the reasons why initially when we came out of India, it was to go into Afghanistan. But within that year, a lot of things changed politically. Mm. And so we made the decision really not to go, partly because the children would have lived such an enclosed life. Mm-hmm. So, you know, had we not had kids, that might have been a bit different.
Yeah. Okay. So that kind of brings us nicely up to where are you now and what does ministry look like for you right now in this context in the UK?
So, I mean, as I said, like in India, our focus was we had a business and that was always something that I've been really passionate about, was about how are we answering the questions or answering the needs within that community. Mm-hmm. So when we came to Liverpool, it's supposed to be a shorter period of time. It's ended up being 10 years rather than 12 months. But in that time, we met an Iranian pastor and he just shared with us and said, oh, I need some English teachers. Would you come and come to my house and just help the asylum seekers? And I was really naive at that point. I knew what an asylum seeker was and refugees, but I didn't really understand the process that they were going through. Mm-hmm. I also did not understand the opportunity that the church had to engage within this community at that point either. And so we went, we taught English one night, it was on a Monday night, and then we had some food together. And then the following week, the room was packed. And so we'd started with like 10, then it was like 25. Mm. The following week, there was a queue in the street. And wow. We were thinking, oh, what do we, you know, what do we do to respond to this? Anyway, it grew and it escalated. And we moved then to a Christian cafe in the town, gave us a space. And again, that sort of moved on through the years. And we now have our own building and we have a registered charity, teaching English, but also all the other things that refugees need as well. So that's locally what we're involved in. But still internationally trying to help people. One of the things that I do is to serve people that want to go and start new projects. They want to start businesses. Mm. We'll mentor them, help them to do startup planning. So that can involve being wherever in the world those people are. So I really appreciate that, although I'm based in the UK and living in the UK, that somehow get to be part of what God's doing in lots of different places. It feels like a real privilege to be able to do that.
That's awesome. Yeah, he always uses our experiences, doesn't he? Whether for good or bad, if we're expelled from a country, then he'll use those same experiences here, wherever we end up.
Yeah.
Would you just give us a little snippet of what's happening with Iranians in this country? Are you seeing Muslims or former Muslims come to Christ? Are they secular Iranians? What's the sort of picture in Liverpool anyway?
I mean, Liverpool has had Iranians come for many years because of the Home Office there. I haven't met so many secular Iranians. I would say the majority of the Iranians that I come across have come out because of persecution. It's not all of them, but I would say a large number of them, and then come into the church or into their Iranian churches or some intercultural churches. But yeah, there are definitely other people that are from other Muslim countries that are coming into contact with communities that are caring for them, that are opening the doors to them. So a lot of those maybe are from Iraq, Syria, Kurds. I'd say that's a smaller group. Definitely the Iranian church is the most vibrant from amongst Middle Eastern countries. But I think the start's definitely glimpses of other things as well. In our own church, we've just started an Arabic speaking group. So that's exciting. Very small, but it's an exciting step forwards. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. And there are so many resources as well these days, aren't there? I mean, there's Welcome Churches, which we know about, a brilliant organization helping churches with refugees and asylum seekers coming into this country. And we've talked about those before on the podcast. Yeah. Any final thoughts just to wrap this up now? Why do you do all this? Why do you put yourself out there and live in crazy places with no electricity and monkeys on the roof and this sort of stuff? Why do we do this? I mean, are there enough people to reach in this country, even from a sort of white British background who need Jesus? Why should we bother ourselves with North India and Pakistan and Afghanistan?
I think that, part of it is within scripture, isn't it, is what God invites us to be part of his redemption of the world and taking his good news of that to places that haven't had any opportunity to hear it. It's not to say that there isn't need in the UK. Of course, there always is.
Yeah.
And I think that goes hand in hand. Like we often say, here, near and far, all at the same time.
Here, near and far.
Yeah.
That's good.
So it's not either or. I think our local church is equally important. I think it's just an opportunity to see what he's doing in different places and an invitation to be part of it. And I just felt like when I felt that invitation, it just felt like a massive privilege.
Yes. Yeah. A privilege and a blessing. I love that. An invitation, a privilege and a blessing. Yes. And of course, there is sacrifice for anything good that you want to do. There's often sacrifice, isn't there? But it's so worth it. Becky, thank you so much. We're going to wrap this up so we can have a bit of question and answer with our audience here today. But I really appreciate you joining us today on the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me. It's been lovely.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today, guys. For more, check out our website, frontiers.org.uk, our social media platforms at frontiersuk, or you can email me personally, matt@frontiers.org.uk. And finally, some of you have emailed in to ask if you can give financially to the work that we do. That would be a huge blessing to us.
as we get out and about speaking of God's heart for all nations, for the lost, for those who have no gospel witness. In particular, we have three things you could give towards. There's a group of about 100 young people, mostly students, who are really considering going overseas, serving the Lord in tough places. So that's one thing you could give towards. Another could be our ministry trainee scheme, where we bring in some usually post-grads for a year or two to serve with us here and do local evangelism. And the third would be our training courses for candidates. We always do 3 or 4 weekends a year where we train those who are already committed to going long-term overseas. So all of those things are great projects if you feel like you'd love to get on board and partner with us in that way. A simple way to do that is to go to our website, frontiers.org.uk. and to click the Give button at the top. Here's a great quote to end with from Amy Carmichael, who spent 55 years in India. Give me the love that leads the way, the faith that nothing can dismay, the hope no disappointments tire, the passion that will burn like fire. Let me not sink to be a clod, make me thy fuel, flame of God. Have a great week, guys, and make sure you don't miss our next episode.